This is the Alternative Leader Podcast with Mary Williams, inspiring the leaders of today, getting to the grit and discovering the gold with powerful insights and learnings, helping us to lead with strength, determination, and compassion.
Welcome to the Alternative Leader Podcast. My name is Mary Williams and I'm the Mind Architect. Today's guest is Claire McDonald. Claire is coming on to share her story with you. It's a story rooted in her childhood, from when her parents separated to her father dying when she was just 12. It's a story of loss and grief, but also a story of immense strength and resilience. Taking Claire from a life where she believed she was living small, as she puts it, to one where she's acting on stage right out in front of an audience. Going from feeling not lovable and not good enough to feeling good enough, so good that she puts herself forward for the opportunities that life is bringing her. It's a story that you and I can all resonate with. It's that story of those times when we feel too afraid to be vulnerable or to take risks. We feel too afraid of failure. Claire talks very candidly and beautifully about her story, her challenges, and how she changed her life and moved forward to be the version of herself that she wants to be now. So let's hand over to Claire. So Claire, just take us back to where you want to begin.
Well, I think actually, whilst on the one hand, I imagined it all began when my father died when I was 12. I actually think it was before then that things started to happen. I think particularly when my father met his second wife and started a family. And then I definitely felt like I wasn't the centre of his universe anymore, that his attention had drifted away, quite understandably. And of course, as an adult, I realise and understand it now. But you know, as a child, it was a huge sense of loss, not only him leaving when he did. And so, you know, he and my mum split up when I was very young, sort of under the age of five. So there was a certain amount of loss there to deal with. And then the loss of him to his new family. Mm. And then it was only a couple of years later that he died very suddenly when I was 12. And so I'd gone through, I suppose, this grieving process that I don't think was ever really truly acknowledged by me or any of the adults around me. And so I think I didn't have that safe space to express how I felt, say how I felt, and to really feel those emotions and to become, I guess, you know, to really kind of let my barriers down. Because I think, you know, the message that came to me when my mum and dad divorced was, it's the best thing. It's the best thing for mum and dad. Mm. You know, they'll be happier. And I think there was a certain amount of recognition that it was going to be difficult for me. But at the same time, the message that I took very clearly was, this is the best thing. Mm. And it didn't feel like the best thing at all. Mm.
That's quite interesting, actually. I want to pick up on that point, because one of the things that I see in clients is where they've learned to distrust their own emotion. Mm-hmm. And so as a child, if your emotion is saying to you, this does not feel good, I don't want this, and yet you're being told, well, it's the best thing, then actually that's almost those first seeds, isn't it, of starting to distrust how you yourself feel.
Yeah, I think that's right. You start to... I think probably what happens is you start to think, well, the adults must know better. They, you know, they must be the ones that know. So, you know, what's going on here? But I also think I think as I look back on it, there was a sense of just not feeling listened to and not feeling understood, not feeling seen, not feeling heard, and being allowed to really kind of, well, like I said before, being allowed to really express how I felt about it.
Yeah. And you know, you've mentioned before this feeling, you know, when we were talking before about that, no one really kind of gave you a safe space. And I like that phrase, safe space, to talk about either the divorce or the death or But, and I think as parents, and I know kind of going through a divorce, you know, myself as parents, it's really painful for us that we almost trying to protect our kids from having any of that pain. And so we, in some respects, as long as they're not talking to us about it, you know, there is that hesitancy to talk to them in case you're making it worse, and you're just avoiding your own stuff. And so I think that's really interesting, isn't it? That for you, not having that safe space, I know as a parent, you know, it's been painful to make myself go to that place to get my child to talk about it. But for you, that's interesting. So can you tell me more about how that felt to not have that space? And how do you think that manifested in you?
I think actually that was probably how I learned to just smile it all off. Mm. You know, people always used to say about me as a child, I was very smiley. And I think that smile was covering a multitude of emotions that I didn't feel like I had permission to express. Mm. So it came, I think probably what happened is it came across as people would ask me what was wrong. I'd say everything's fine.
Yeah.
That I know I never ever gave away that anything was wrong.
Mm.
Mm. And I think as a result, well, there was just so much kind of tucking everything away.
Mm.
And a certain amount of underlying sense of isolation, really. Mm. That there wasn't, I think one of the key things was just that inability to form friendships and connections.
Mm.
And to trust people with anything more than the kind of surface level, if you like. And so certainly going through my childhood and my teenage years, I would have friends, but I didn't really, you know, I don't kind of look back and think, oh yes, you know, my best friend this and my best friend that, you know, so I would make connections, but they wouldn't last, they weren't sustainable for me.
Mm.
And that sort of came to a head actually in my later teenage years when I was about 15. So at the point where my dad had died 3 years ago, my mum reacted very badly to it and struggled with her mental health. So there was another sense of not having a safe space, disconnection there. And you know, I'd had a good friend who then ended up meeting a boyfriend. And so, you know, I'd hang out with them, but I was very much on the periphery. I had a group of friends that I was hanging out with who I thought were great friends, but there was a distance that emerged between us. And I don't know if I drove that, or I don't know if it's just simply, you know, 14-year-olds don't know how to cope with someone who's going through a grieving process. Yeah. So I experienced a lot of disconnection and a lot of sort of lack of quality friendships and quality relationships throughout my childhood and my teenage years.
And do you think that followed you into adult life, or did you manage to sort of resolve it by then?
100% it did. Yes, 100%. I've always been very good at getting to know people, you know, being very warm and connecting with people straight away to a particular level. But I would get to a certain point and I was just too frightened to go any further.
Mm.
And so I would make friendships very quickly. They would go to a certain depth, and probably there was a certain amount of oversharing.
Yeah.
Because I didn't have a way of really, because I didn't really have a way of moderating what was appropriate and what wasn't, you know, that sort of sense of desperation a little bit about desperately wanting people to connect with me and getting it wrong, not knowing how to do that.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because you mentioned, you know, when we were talking about keeping you small.
Yeah.
And so you can see, can't you, actually, if you've got a child that's kind of doesn't really trust her own feelings because she's not sure. And actually then is kind of withdrawing, almost kind of pulling in from any depth of relationship and basically trying not to get hurt. That's what you were trying to do, is not get hurt. You know, and we know, you know, from the kind of neurology, this is just the brain saying, oh, I don't want to do that again. So actually, if I don't make any friendships with anyone, you know, that are really deep, I won't get hurt, which, you know, as we know, is a kind of wrong equation. How else do you think this kind of keeping small manifested it I know itself in your life. I know you've talked about, you know, this lack of vulnerability, like wanting to be vulnerable, and you mentioned a few other things. So can you talk to me about how else it affected you?
The idea of kind of keeping small. I mean, it was a reluctance to take any risks and to put myself in a position where I could get anything wrong. Or I could fail. And interestingly, certainly my identity as a young child I was always the smart one. I was always the brainy one, the one who was going to go to Oxford or Cambridge. You know, that was a real strong sense of identity for me that I think was thrust upon me a lot of the time by the adults around me who would remind me of that. And when my dad died, academically, everything went down the pan. And so I assumed that, oh, it's just because I'm a teenager, you know, I'm in a big wide world here. I'm a small fish in a huge pond, and I'm not outstanding anymore academically. And so there was a sort of sense of losing my identity a little bit. But also, I guess I just thought, well, that isn't me. I can't, you know, I'm going to find things hard now. I've suddenly started to find things hard.
Yes.
And I didn't know how to cope with finding things hard. And so staying small was a great way of just going, okay, that's just me now. I'm not made for better things. I'm not this academic, you know, I don't have this academic prowess that I thought I had before. And so I didn't take many risks. And I remember very clearly, I always wanted to act. When I was a child, and I went for an audition. They had a big, you know, the Amateur Theatrical Society in the town that I was in had a big, you know, open audition for all the kids and all the schools around Basingstoke, where I grew up. And I went along to the audition. It was a 2-day audition, went along and didn't get through to the second day. Had absolutely no resilience in response to that. So I didn't get through. It knocked my confidence completely. My mum was always very mindful to not be the pushy mum.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it was, you know, there was no sense of, let's see if we can build some resilience here. You know, okay, stand up, dust yourself off.
Yeah.
What are you going to do now? You know, don't let it get you down. Don't let the failure overwhelm you. And that's exactly what happened. You know, the sort of any time I stepped out and I tried to be vulnerable and I tried to be courageous, if it didn't work, it was absolutely shrinking right back down to small.
It is really fascinating. And I think I just actually want to kind of step in and explain to people who kind of might not know, you know, neurologically why that happens, because I think it's really important, because what the brain does is it goes through any painful experience and then it says, I don't like that. I don't want to go through that again. So I'm going to create a set of behaviors which will stop that happening. And that's unique to everybody. So for you, it was, you know, I'm not going to reach out for the things I reach out for. And if I reach out for something and I don't happen to get it, like that audition, that's just evidence, you know, that I shouldn't have gone for it in the first place, and that I'm not big enough, I'm not worthy enough, I'm not strong enough, all of these negative things. And that, you know, actually, I'm not going to take risks because then I'll get hurt. And I'm not going to try something because I might fail. And I'm not going to do this because then I'll be vulnerable. And it just creates these behaviors where you know, you don't go for promotion when you're older, or you don't make friends when you're younger, and you don't go and do more acting because that's just one audition. And so I just kind of wanted to explain the neurology of that for some of people who might be sitting listening thinking, oh my God, that's me, but that didn't happen to me. It doesn't matter what the trigger is. And it doesn't actually even have to be anything huge. It can be something really tiny that the brain takes that from. So, you know, it's really interesting for people to understand that. And obviously I'll talk about it in the book. But for you, you were saying that you felt that all of this added up to the kind of, I'm not good enough and I'm not lovable.
Yeah, definitely that sense of I'm not lovable, because the relationship with my dad had drifted and drifted. And the message I was carrying with that was, you must get in touch with your dad. No, so this sort of this sense of having a lot of responsibility at a young age.
And so that's interesting, because that's something I hear from a lot of clients, which is when there's a separation, the child feels responsible for keeping up the contact and the communication rather than it being the adult's job. And actually, I was speaking to a client a couple of weeks ago who was saying that at 10, She had actually said to her dad, I just don't want to see you anymore, you know, because they haven't turned up for something. And the dad left, you know, sort of, you know, not left the family, but had already left, but left her effectively, and just didn't see her again until she was in her mid-20s. And she totally blamed herself for that. And I said, you were 10. No adult listens to a 10-year-old. You know, actually, it's adult responsibility to say, you know, you're crossing me and I need to resolve that or give you some time. You know, that's not your decision. And so I guess, you know, my message to anyone getting divorced is, you know, it's your responsibility to keep the communication. It's your responsibility to still parent, I guess.
Yeah.
And actually, sometimes I think parents, even meaning really well, are so busy trying to do the right thing that if the kid says, I don't want this, that they just kind of go with it rather than actually working through that thing.
That's absolutely agree. Absolutely. I think it's very easy. Yeah, it's very easy to trust the child, isn't it? In terms of, well, if you don't want that, that's fine.
Yes.
And I think a lot of it is wanting, I think for the adults, it's wanting to avoid making it worse.
Yeah.
It's wanting to avoid the conflict. Yeah. You know, maybe some adults are telling themselves that they are empowering the child by allowing them to do that. But it's absolutely overwhelming. And I think actually in the sessions, either the sessions that we had or in the many, many psychotherapy sessions I had, that really needed to be explained to me, even as an adult. Mm. And, you know, in order to kind of let go of the fact that responsibility was thrust upon me too early, that wasn't the right type of responsibility. And that allowed me then to take on responsibility now as an adult. And that was absolutely key in my process of change.
And I think, I mean, so, you know, I've sort of had two long-term marriages, two divorces and two sets of children with each one. And, you know, definitely the second one was harder on my little ones who were 4 and 6 at the time. And I remember my son, who was 4 at the time, having to be kind of almost pulled off me crying to go and spend time with his dad, you know, and I'd come in and just sit down and cry and absolutely go through that thing of, should I be making him go? You know, if he's that unhappy. And obviously I did the checks of, you know, is he safe? Is there an issue here? And obviously talked to him about it. But I knew that actually once he was there, he was okay. His preference was to be at home with me, but he liked his time with his dad. Now he's now 15 and, you know, and he has a great relationship with his dad. Now, if I hadn't enabled him to build that resilience, to go through that, this is really tough being away from mum because I'm 4 and it's tough being with dad, he's maybe not quite as emotionally available, you know, actually if I hadn't helped him develop that resilience, they wouldn't have this really good relationship now. And I think it is tough for a parent when you're going through stuff, and actually for you it might be easier if the kids, you know, didn't see the person and they could drift off into the background, you know, male or female. And I think it's so important that we go, no, it's not this child's responsibility. I am the caretaker of this relationship. And it doesn't matter how much you don't get on with that ex-partner anymore. The relationship with the child is a separate issue. They might have been an awful partner, but they might be a fantastic parent. Yeah. And it's that piece is so key. It's not the child's responsibility to deal with that relationship. So in some respects at 12, and I think it's an interesting thing where I think size is an issue, because at 12, male or female, you're starting to look kind of mini adult, really, aren't you, at that, you know, that age. And I think you know, you have an element of confidence, and you know, you're at secondary school, so you're, you know, sorting all your own bag, and you've kind of transitioned out this kind of little kid stage. And I think it's really easy for adults to look at kids of that age and go, oh, well, you know, you're kind of an adult. You must really know what you want and what you're doing. And actually, of course, they're not. They're such little children still at that age.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, I think the whole mum not being the pushy mum type piece is there. Definitely, you know, she's not one for conflict either. You know, very much wants to smooth everything over. And I think it's as much about the parent's discomfort as it is about the child. You know, and it's all well meaning, and this is one of the things that you know, going through therapy and going through a lot of work on myself, you know, coming to that point where you understand that we're all just doing our best at the time under the circumstances. It doesn't feel like that when you're a child, because you just don't have the way of processing it. You don't have the maturity to be able to recognize that.
And I think, as you said, as an adult, you go through even, you know, your first few little relationships, you understand a breakup, you understand that people fall out of love with each other. You start to get this adult understanding that actually, if you don't want to stay with somebody, well, then maybe that's how it felt for my parents. Yeah. But like you say, as a child, you do not have that understanding. I always think it's a bit like when kids find out their teacher's name. You know, like, oh my God, they've got a name. They're a real person with a name. I found out their name, you know, and it's a bit like this sudden understanding. Of course they've got a name because they're just a person. That's their job. But as a kid, you're like, but their teacher, you know, they're this kind of omnipotent, you know, thing. And I think that is the problem, is that parents are viewed like that. You know, and I know that I say to my kids, you know, I was literally talking to my son, he's lovely and actually exactly where he needs to be, but in that slightly obnoxious teenage stage, you know, and he was being really sullen with me over like what he was going to do at sixth form and all this stuff. And eventually I kind of just lost it a bit and just said, oh my God, do you think I want to get up and go around a sixth form for the fifth time? Because he's the fifth child, you know. And I was like, and talk about what select, do you think I wake up thinking I'm going to go and make his life hell today? You know, and I kind of just launched him a little bit. And, you know, I said to him, you know, I am a human being and I've got other things I can do with my day. And I think, you know, but kids look at parents as just being, but you're there to look after me. You know, why would you have any life? Or, you know, who does it matter who you love? Because you two are my parents. And, you know, I think that when you get older, you understand that, and then things start to click into place more. But unfortunately, of course, in some respects, the damage is already done. So it's whether you can then take that adult learning back to the kind of child year and say, okay, hang on, you didn't know this. Yeah. And I know for you, a lot of that work has been quite transformative to help you start living big.
Yes. I mean, absolutely, absolutely transformative. And it's really interesting, having come out the other side of it, how I feel like an adult now for the first time in my technically adult life. It took me to get to my early to mid 40s before I sat. I don't even know if it was a single moment, but that sense of, oh, I finally let go of that child. I finally become an adult, and the responsibility thing, I'm cool with that. I'm really cool with that, you know, and I can take feedback and criticism, and I can have conversations on an adult level. I don't need to slip into child mode to get my needs met. I don't have to become the parent figure with anybody or with myself. You know, that kind of that adult space was so eye-opening to finally feel like I'd come of age at 43 or whenever it was. And the idea that I was essentially stuck in that child phase for so much of my adult life, and how that's essentially the thing that's keeping me small. You know, if you're in that child space, you're never going to step out. You're never going to step out and do the stuff that you think you can do as an adult, because you don't want to take the responsibility, because you don't feel resilient, because being vulnerable was really tough when you didn't have a safe space to be vulnerable. So I was carrying all of those beliefs and all of that experience with me, and not taking risks with jobs. I mean, I hopped around from all kinds of different jobs and made excuses why I didn't go for things all the time. You know, it's the reason why I didn't form very many close relationships and kept everything fairly surface level. It's the reason why I didn't pursue any more acting, or I did a little bit, but I kept it at a sort of safe level. Like, you know, I would be in the background a bit more, and not really have the confidence to push myself much further than just the sort of periphery of my comfort zone and that sort of risk space. But as a result, you know, as a result of having gone through the therapy and worked with you, I mean, the changes that happened in me in that period afterwards were, I mean, it was, I didn't recognize myself. I didn't recognize myself. You know, I was doing things that I wouldn't have dreamt of doing. No, that's not true. I would have dreamt of doing, and for a second wouldn't have thought it was even possible.
I do remember seeing you, because obviously we did sessions over quite a long time in the end, wasn't it, because they were quite spaced out. And then I didn't see you for about a year, and then you popped back to see me, and I remember just as you walked into the room, there was this, your head was held up high, your shoulders were, it was literally like watching someone else come in. And actually, even sitting here talking to you, obviously, you know, listeners can't see you, but I can, just the way you're holding yourself, you know, everything about you is just like, this is my space in the world, and it's mine, and I own it, you know. And it is, it's really beautiful, actually, to see. And it is interesting, because I totally remember that. I remember going to see a therapist about 10 years ago or so, and I said, I just feel like I'm the 12-year-old in the room. Doesn't matter who I'm with, you know, whether I know so much more than them, it doesn't matter. I just feel like I'm this 12-year-old in the room. And she cleared that for me. And I remember kind of, it was almost like lifting my head up, and suddenly I was this adult. And so I it's a weird thing. Other people might not understand, but I totally get that. I feel like an adult now, and I feel like an adult, and it allows you to back your opinion and do what's right and fail and do all these things that, you know, you have kept small before. So I think it's lovely. And you talked to me before about, you know, losing this perfectionism that you had. And the fact that, you know, you don't mind failing now, you just kind of go, okay, you know, something goes wrong, you know, I take what's useful from it and I move on, and all those things. So how has that changed your life now?
I mean, it's just part of the bigger piece of being willing to take risks. But I think it's also the perfectionism ties in so much with procrastination. And that was another thing, another symptom of me being stuck in that space. That child space I just couldn't get started on things. You know, the idea of it not being perfect. I was frozen by the idea of it. And I guess the perfectionism is something that I haven't necessarily consciously worked on, but it's become something that comes up a lot less as a result of the other stuff that I've done. And I wouldn't have done the things I'd have done had I not dropped that perfectionism, whether consciously or unconsciously. I actually think teaching, I was teaching in my mid to late 30s, and I think that was possibly the start of the process of being willing, because, you know, anyone who's been a teacher knows that there's an awful lot of scrutiny when you're training and when, you know, you're being watched by your manager and everything. And so, you know, I learned to see the value of feedback as a teacher. I was, though, still carrying a lot of insecurity about whether I was good enough. Like, you know, the thing that we discussed earlier, and whether or not I was worthy or lovable or any of that sort of stuff. And so that was probably possibly the start of losing the perfectionism, but the perfectionism definitely didn't go until I learned to love myself and be compassionate and to take risks and to try things and fail and stand up again and try something else and fail again. And the perfectionism just is crippling. It's absolutely crippling. And you know, it's not that I'm free of it now. Sometimes, you know, what happens is I notice it and I go, oh, okay, you're starting to go into the detail too much. You're starting to cross every I, dot every T, stall starting anything. But I'm able to notice it now and go, right, okay, what's going on here? You know, and have a word with myself and just kind of say it's fine. It's fine, it doesn't have to be perfect.
And I think so. I work with a lot of perfectionists, and certainly used to be one myself. I think that we have to also admit that we do have different personality traits. So I'm somebody who's just very organized. You know, I like things to look neat and tidy. I like, you know, things filed in the right place. You know, to open a filing drawer gives me joy. You know, I just have to admit that. You know, I genuinely think sometimes my favorite job would just be filing stuff in the right place. You know, it's a lovely monotonous job. But I think it is really important that sometimes we can say, and it's okay, actually, here being perfect is good. you know, I don't know, keeping our financial records perfect is really useful. But it's knowing where you can put it down. Yeah. And you know, and I have a lot of project managers, you know, that I work with, and a lot of CEOs. And actually, some stuff does just have to be dotted and crossed, but other stuff doesn't. And so for me, the real value in the learning and the moving forward is being able to go, yeah, it's kicking in a bit here, but it should be. This is correct. But actually, it's kicking in here. But hang on, I don't need to do this bit perfectly. And it's finding that natural balance, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. That sense of, is this a necessary part of the job? Yeah. Or is it triggering those thoughts and those emotions around perfectionism that's not serving me, that's not healthy?
Yeah. And I think, when I think about everything, not just the subject, you know, there's a certain amount of stuff that it's okay to accept. So I know, as you probably know, I grew up with my mother being a compulsive hoarder. And so I'm very much tidy house, tidy mind. And so you can guarantee if you walk into my house and it's full of clutter, it's either very transitory. So I've kind of got decorators in at the moment. It's transitory. So it's a bit like camping and it's fun. But if it's long term, actually, I'm probably not doing very well. And so actually for me, if I find myself sort of going, oh, I'm feeling a bit stressed, I'm going to clean out that drawer, that's actually quite useful. You know, it's okay for me to go, that is actually quite healthy for me. That's not, you know, that's not a problem. If I'm so stressed that I'm eating a whole carrier bag full of food, that becomes a problem. So I think I think when you become clearer in your mind, you're able to almost look at your little flaws and go, this one's okay, actually, you know, but this one I need to do a bit more work on. And I think that's the very powerful thing, isn't it? That even now on your journey where you're in this amazing space, I'm sure there's things that you kind of come up with where you're like, oh, I think maybe I'm, you know, I need to work on that. You know, and actually that thing I do, I'm just going to let that go. That's fine. So there's that acceptance of self that comes with it.
I think that's right. And the more you kind of work on yourself and you go through that journey, people often talk about it being an onion, don't they? Peeling back the layers of the onion. I actually heard somebody say a much, much nicer analogy, which is just like pass the parcel. You know, who wants to be peeling onions? It's not pleasant. Pass the parcel, like the excitement of taking off a layer. Like, what's underneath that layer? And the excitement of discovering something new or kind of releasing this lovely prize out of the layer that you've uncovered, whether or not that's, you know, losing the perfectionism or loving yourself more or being braver and more vulnerable. I don't know, but it's, you know, it's absolutely the more that I do, the more I kind of go, oh right, and now's the point where I need to look at this. And so, you know, I've looked at the responsibility thing, and that's good, and I've looked at the vulnerability. I mean, the vulnerability thing still will be a thing that I'll need to work on. I don't think that just because I've recognized the importance of vulnerability and how it's allowed me to form greater, you know, richer, deeper relationships and allowed me to step out more and do more things, it's never easy. Vulnerability is never easy. And I, you know, one of my absolute favorite experts on the issue, Brené Brown, I mean, she, you know, I love that she talks about it, and she says, you know, she's a vulnerability researcher, but she never finds this vulnerability stuff easy.
No.
and it, of course it won't be, you know, and what in life is ever easy and actually really, really worthwhile?
And isn't it the case really that actually if you're being vulnerable, then if you're finding something easy, you're not being vulnerable, because effectively vulnerable really it's another word for stretch. It's another word for challenge. What it's saying is I am going outside of my comfort zone. And so if you were finding that really easy, you're not outside of your comfort zone.
Exactly. No? By definition, vulnerability is hard.
And it's meant to be.
But it reaps so many rewards, many rewards. And I think it's interesting because the next, for me, at the moment, the next layer that's coming through, that's a really important thing for me to focus on is really tuning into my emotions and really giving myself space to process them. And I've been doing a lot of work. I've read an incredible book by a lady who looks at emotional, she's an emotional researcher, and I'm sure that might come up later.
What's the book called?
Emotional Agility.
Okay,
interesting. By Susan David. Fantastic book. But yeah, for me, so it's one of the things she talks about is the ability to hold your emotions and experience them in a way that is neither, you're neither kind of keeping them close mm-hmm. so they're overwhelming mm-hmm. or you're not holding them at arm's length mm-hmm. so they become tiring to mm-hmm. hold. You're kind mm-hmm. of, you know, they're a certain distance, and that ability to notice how I'm feeling, to mm-hmm. allow myself to feel it, mm-hmm. but without it being overwhelming. Mm-hmm. So I think previously in the past, I've either pushed them away, mm. hope they go away. Of course they don't. They come out in some other kind of toxic or unhelpful way, or wear them far too close to my chest. Mm. And both those approaches don't work. And so the stuff I've been doing recently is very much about, okay, rather than, and even just sort of changing my language around how I think and talk about my emotions, rather than saying I am angry or I am sad, just twisting it around to saying I feel some sadness, or even I notice that there are feelings of sadness or anger coming up, and the ability to kind of step back and almost be a kind of neutral observer to what's happening inside me. And it's
very powerful,
really, really powerful, and really really, really important. And it's one of the things my job as a parent, I think, is to educate my children to be able to feel their emotions, be able to identify their emotions and be okay with feeling what they feel. And I think one of the things in modern life, especially, and that's not to say it wasn't something that happened before, but we have got access to so many things that can numb those emotions.
Yeah.
You know, we've got the internet, we've got instant access to any, you know, any drug, any food, you know, alcohol, sex, shopping, you know, you name it. There's just something out there that will numb any emotions we don't want to feel.
Yeah.
And I think it's a huge, huge problem.
Yes.
I've noticed a massive difference just being willing to, I think what it is a sense of, you need a sense of not being overpowered by your emotions. And I think people can be very intimidated by what they see as the size of their emotions. It's all a bit much. And you know, that was me in the past. Definitely. I would, you know, I can't possibly have any tears, because if I start crying now, I won't ever stop crying. And I won't be able to look after, you know, a 2-year-old and a 6-year-old. I won't be able to go into work looking okay, and I won't be able to function. And that sense of just feeling so overwhelmed that you can't possibly bear the idea of feeling something.
It is interesting, isn't it? Because when you were talking like that, it made me think of, it's that safe space again, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's having that safe space. And also, not only practically. So I remember when my mum died, you know, a bit the same kind of, like, actually, I can't start crying because I won't stop crying. You know, and I've had other experiences of that in my life. And it's kind of, where is the safe space where the children aren't going to walk in, or I've, you know, have to look great for a client soon, or where is that safe space? And you end up kind of blocking it all up. And I think I would say, you know, the majority of the clients I see, that emotional overwhelm is key. I mean, I think in the book I call it an emotional tsunami, because for me that's how it feels when I'm taken over. It's just like, and anyone in the vicinity gets covered as well, you know.
Exactly. Stand like, aside. I'm about to
verbal diarrhea, or the verbal the tears is just chaos. And so when you're aware of that, then you learn to hold it. And I think the beautiful part of this journey is exactly as you said, it's being able to kind of go, actually, I can let this go because I recognize it's going to be 2 or 3 minutes, or I can let this go because I've got 10 minutes. I can let this go because I recognize it's okay for my kids to see me cry. Or, you know, I know I've had twice when I've cried with a client in session, because that's been appropriate to do so, you know. And so I think it's when you start to not be afraid of your emotions that you start to be that adult, to lose the fear, to feel that vulnerability, to be able to say, and I think I always say to people, you know, where I'm trying to get you to is where you are not afraid of yourself. You're not afraid of any memory. You're not afraid of any emotion. You're not afraid of anything, because either you know that you can deal with it, however tough it is, or you know that you've got people who can help you deal with it.
Yeah.
But all will be fine.
Yeah.
And when you get to that, life opens up.
I think you've hit the nail on the head there, because I remember having come out of one of one of our sessions that we had together, and really being able to engage with that sense of, I know I'll be okay. I really, and I felt it so deeply. And I think I might have told you this at the time, but it was such a profound change that I came home and I opened up the cupboard where all my emergency antidepressants were, and I took them all out of the cupboard and I put them straight into the wheelie bin. I'm trying to think of the words to describe it. You know how sometimes we can be very kind of tumultuous.
Yes, it wasn't impulsive.
It wasn't just like, oh, impulsive, right, get rid of it.
Yeah.
I had such a deep sense of whatever it is that happens, I'll be okay. I'll be okay. And I haven't, you know, that was about 5 years ago. I haven't looked back since. I don't for a minute think I need antidepressants ever again. And that's quite a sweeping statement from somebody who spent all of her adult life from the age of 21, when I was first diagnosed with depression, up into, you know, up to my early 40s, constantly off and on antidepressants, in and out of therapy all the time. And the sense of freedom and release and almost a kind of sense of rebirth in some ways, like, oh, that's it now. I know I'm going to be fine. And it was such a sense of serenity about it. It wasn't, I wasn't bullshitting myself.
Yeah.
You know, it was a deep and fundamental sense that that I'm okay and I will be.
So that sort of deep shift at your core, isn't it? Where you, it's almost like a quiet understanding, like you say, that serenity.
Yes,
but rather than that kind of, oh yes, I'm going to throw everything out of my wardrobe, you know, so rather than that, it's that kind of, I just know this. It is beautiful. It's a beautiful thing to see, but it is a lovely thing to feel. And I think I've often thought I should write a blog or a book even, maybe, on why okay is a beautiful space, because I think people kind of go, oh, I'm okay, and actually okay is just lovely. It's such a lovely space to be in. Okay, I'm okay. It's a simple two-word, you know, two-letter, you know, okay, I'm okay. It's just, it's a beautiful space to be in. But I know one of the things that you did do is you did go and do one of your childhood dreams, didn't you? You went and acted. Last time I saw you, you were looking into acting. Yes. So tell me about that.
Yes. So I had done, actually, throughout my adult life, I had dabbled a bit in some acting. And so in my 30s, I did my first ever audition to be in the chorus for West Side Story. And so I got to do that, and that was amazing. But then I wasn't brave enough to carry on. And so I kind of pulled back and stopped there. But in the village where I live, there's a very good theatre company. And for several years, I'd thought, oh, I'd love to go and do the panto. That would be fun. Never went to see it, you know, always kind of has, you know, hid, I think probably hid behind the, oh, I can't because the kids, the bedtime, blah, blah, blah. And then I went off to audition for the panto, for the village panto. I didn't go for a part, partly because I didn't think that it was reasonable to commit the time to that, and that was genuine, that was a genuine sense of don't overcommit yourself, let's get real. It was at the point where my husband was working 12 hours a day, you know, out of the house 5 days a week, and I had to be realistic. But I did it, you know, I stepped forward and I did it and did the panto, and then the next show, and this was the real, you know, real moment of vulnerability. The next show was Heidi High, and you know, anyone of our kind of age group, probably remembers Heidi High. It was a bit of an iconic sitcom back in the day. And I thought it would just be so much fun, because I realized that a lot of the performing I'd done before, I've done some dancing and I've done a little bit of singing as part of a chorus and a little bit of acting with a friend of mine in Oxford who is a filmmaker. But what I actually really liked is the comedy. Really liked the comedy. And I really wanted to be funny. I really wanted to do that. And Heidi High was a great opportunity for it. And do you know, I don't even know where the idea came from, but there was something inside me, that voice of inner wisdom popped up. And I thought, I reckon I could have a go at Gladys Pugh. And there's another part of me, going, what are you talking about, Claire? Like, you've never acted on stage, never, you know, apart from having your one-liner in the panto. This woman is an iconic figure of British sitcom. Like, if you don't get the accent right, it's going to sound terrible. And you've never done this on stage before. But then I thought, you know, that deep sense of knowing and the sense of, it was partly the ability, I think, having given myself the permission to fail and recognize that it would be a challenge, but knowing I could take on the responsibility and having that deep sense of, I'll be okay.
Yeah,
I can do this. I'm up to the challenge. And so I told a couple of people I was planning to audition. I don't know what they thought about it. I think they just said, oh, go for it, because they didn't really know what else to say.
Yeah.
And I, you know, I watched back the sitcoms, the, you know, stuff on YouTube, and I practiced the accents, and I looked at the mannerisms, and I really studied her and practiced, went along to the audition and did the audition. And they said to me, thank you for doing such a beautiful audition. And then a few days later, I got an email saying, you know, thank you. You know, that was a great audition. We want you to play the part of Gladys. And I was simultaneously surprised and yet utterly confident that I was the right person for the job.
Fantastic. That's lovely.
And so I, you know, the perfectionist me of old would have just panicked, would have panicked. You know, the me that didn't rate my ability to take on responsibility and do new things and to risk myself out of my comfort zone would have gone, oh, it's no, don't do it. Either pull out or do it and do it badly so that you can show yourself that you're not good enough, that you're not capable of responsibility and all these other things that I've talked about. But I took it quite seriously. At the time, I wasn't working. So I had a little bit of time when the kids are in school to be able to rehearse. I loved every minute of it. I was lucky enough to work with somebody in the theatre group who was Welsh and was able to give me a few pointers. And we got to performance week and it went really well. And I had the time of my life doing it. I absolutely loved every second. And I felt confident in my performance and I had really good feedback from people. I had a lovely review from the NODA representative, you know, the people, the umbrella organisation for amateur theatre. And the director was really positive. And just all in all, I just had some wonderful, wonderful feedback and I felt great. And I thought, finally, this is what I'm capable of.
Yeah.
And all of these years, I just have kept myself small and safe because I've been too frightened. And it actually makes me feel quite emotional about it now. Because there's a part of me thinking, God, what could have I achieved? What could I have actually done? Had I been able to give myself the space to be vulnerable, the permission to fail, and to have that deep sense of, I can do this, I'll be okay.
It's a journey, isn't it? It's such a journey.
It's a huge journey, huge, huge journey. And in all honesty, you know, I don't want to regret the times that have gone by because that's the way life is. But I feel so grateful that over this journey, through the people that I've met and the things that have happened and my own determination and strength of character has meant that I have turned it around and made things happen. And I am so proud of having achieved that, knowing how far I've had to come.
I think it's fantastic, and I'm so glad that you got that part. I think that's, you know, it is fantastic, isn't it? It's almost like a movie story, you know, and I think it's just beautiful. Actually, I think it's really beautiful, and I know you well enough to know you know you're just going to keep growing, and so if you're doing this now, you know what happens in the next sort of 20, 30, 40 years. It'd be so interesting to see, you know, where your journey continues to take you. I think it'd be fantastic to see. Thank you for sharing.
You're welcome.
So I'm going to ask you the kind of three questions that I ask everybody. So, you know, the first one is, if you were to give a piece of advice to people listening, thinking, you know, some of that resonates or all of that resonates with me, I want to do something today. Yeah. What would your advice be?
My advice would be find a way to be vulnerable. Mm. And that might mean reading about it. That might mean getting help from a professional. But without vulnerability, the willingness to be vulnerable, then you will stay small and nothing will change. So be willing to be vulnerable. Only one step at a time is fine. One small step at a time is fine. But if you can dig in and find the courage to do that, then everything will come from that. Relationships get better. Your life is more fulfilled. You start to achieve things that you wouldn't have achieved before. But it's about finding the courage to be vulnerable. Mm.
I think that's lovely. And as you said, Brené Brown is amazing on vulnerability and has several books on it. And her wonderful TED Talk on vulnerability is just amazing as well. So I recommend anybody who's interested in vulnerability to head off and read that. And just say, obviously, if you're interested in the kind of neuroscience of things, my book will explain that to you as well. The second question is there a book, a film, or a piece of music that you either feel sentimental about on that journey or that helped you? So I'm wondering what you'll say.
You know what I did? I knew this was coming, this question. And I thought, I did think about it a lot, because music has been such a key part of this journey. Such a key part. It's helped me access those emotions. It's helped me express things. There are pieces of music that remind me of my dad that I've needed to play over and over again to process some of that grief. Music is just such a something that goes so deeply into my soul that I don't think I can't pick out a single piece of music that has been key in this journey, but it will always help me access my emotions and help me just, you know, tick along in life. But I think I'm also an avid consumer of personal development books and, you know, self-help books. That's been probably the reason why I'm now in coaching finally, another thing that you know has come as a result of all this work, is becoming a coach and NLP practitioner. And without doubt, this won't come as a surprise to you or probably anyone listening, without a doubt, the book that out of all of the amazing and interesting books that I've read, Brené Brown's Daring Greatly.
It's a beautiful book.
Which is the book that you gave me at the end of the retreat. And, you know, I'm saying this in all honesty, this is not a setup. You know, I'm not saying this just because it's your podcast. Without a shadow of a doubt, it turned my life around. It really, I read it, and I think the interesting thing about that book is that when you gave it to me, or when it arrived in the post, I kind of looked at it and kind of went, oh, what's all this about?
You know, why did you send me this?
I did that weird defensive thing of no, it doesn't apply to me. Oh, it can't possibly be. Yeah, it can't possibly be. Oh, well, okay, fine, I'll just read it. But it, you know, the scales lifted from my eyes as I read it. And I was also reminded of another book that's been really important for me, which is the Winnie the Pooh books. And there's a fantastic quote from Winnie the Pooh. I'm not sure which book it was, but he says, you know, you can't just stay in your own corner of the forest. Mm. You have to go out and find other people. And that's probably not even the right word. So yeah. Apologies to anyone who's a purist and knows more about Winnie the Pooh than I do. But essentially that was Winnie the Pooh talking about vulnerability and stepping out of your comfort zone. You know, you can't stay in your own corner of the forest. Mm. Mm. But you have to be willing to be vulnerable in order to go out into other people's forest. Mm. And that with, you know, that with Brené Brown's Daring Greatly, just the ability to just step forward. Mm. And yes, it's difficult, but it is the key to a fulfilling and rich life.
It's lovely. Just
blew my mind. It blew my mind. So I'm very, very grateful that you sent it in my direction.
I always go on just what instinctively feels right, and it felt right. So it also struck a chord.
Spot on instincts, absolutely spot on instincts. Yeah.
Okay. And my third question is, if you were standing in front of world leaders today, what would you say to them?
So this, I think this is an interesting question, because my first thought about it is leadership. I mean, it's an area that you work in as well. Leadership, it's really difficult for people to take advice and to listen to someone else's message. And so I was mindful that actually, if this was happening for real, I wouldn't want to be too, I wouldn't want to be too negative. I would want to deliver something that was actually very positive. And so rather than saying, you know, stop thinking about this and stop doing this, it would, for me, the message would be that well-being for the people of the world is absolutely the crucial key to having a harmonious world. But I think the important thing is for me to say to world leaders is we need to stop being fearful of each other.
Yeah.
And because as soon as we become fearful of people who are not like us or are different from us, then that's generating conflict and anxiety and defensiveness and aggression. And so if we can let go of the fear of difference between ourselves, then we are much more able to embrace a world that is more harmonious and basically benefits everybody. And you know, that might not be a message that resonates particularly with a lot of leaders, but I think you know, if you're going to get pragmatic about it, when everybody's happier, when we are working together, then we don't spend the money, the time, the energy on conflict resolution, on conflict itself. We don't spend the money on fighting crime. We're not so worried about mental health issues because everybody's healthier. Fundamentally we're saving money. What's not to love about saving money, as well as the world a happier place? So that's
very practical.
Well, you know, putting a practical twist on it, because not everyone's motivated by the emotions.
I don't agree.
There you go.
Thank you so much. You know, I love talking to you. But I think what's really lovely is that you've just shared a story that is, in some respects, very normal. You know, lots of people go through this. Lots of people feel like this. And just how lovely for, you know, people to be able to listen. And I'm sure so many people listening will just go, oh, my gosh, you know, that reminds me of me. And I think that's the beauty of it, actually. It's such an everyday story. But it's actually extraordinary in the way that you've moved through it and come out the other end. I think it's beautiful. So thank you so much. And if people do want to get in touch with you for any reason, how would they find you?
So they can find me on LinkedIn. I'm on LinkedIn, Claire McDonald. They can also send me an email, ClaireMcDonaldCoaching@outlook.com. I'm sure that'll be in the notes of the podcast. Yes, and so the spelling, I won't bother about the spelling now, but the spelling is particular. So absolutely reach out, get in touch. I'd love to hear if any of this resonated with anybody, if it gives them hope. I think people's stories are so powerful, and I'd love to hear from people. And obviously, you know, I work with people now to do exactly that kind of stuff. And so if anyone, you know, wants to talk about that, that's great too.
Brilliant. That's lovely. Claire, thank you very, very much. And, you know, thank you for coming on and being vulnerable.
Yeah, you see what I did there?
Very
good. Got to put my money where my mouth is, haven't I? Thank you so much, Mary.
One of the difficult things, isn't it? Our job is, oh, I've got to do this because otherwise it's poor modelling. Lovely. Okay, take care.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Mary Williams, as you know, and thank you so much for listening to the Alternative Leader podcast. I search for guests to bring you lessons and learnings that can help move you forward in your life, help you achieve the success that you want to, in whatever way that shows up for you, to help you lead powerfully, whether that's in your own life, as your parenting, your personal, or your professional, and make you the best that you can be. If you've enjoyed the show, please rate and review it, and please share it with as many people as you think also want to move forward and gain success in their lives. If you want to find out more about me, go over to my website, which is www.mary-williams.com. That's www.mary, which is M-A-R-I-Williams.com, and you'll find links to all of my social media profiles there. There's also a Facebook community that you can join, and again, all the links will be on the website too. I hope you have an absolutely fantastic day, and thank you so much for listening.